What's up, everybody? Kyle Tierman here, and I just got a new watch. This isn't an ad. Well, it's kind of an ad, except they're not paying me. I got a Casio watch, and it was like $25. Got it from Big Five, and I wear this thing all the time now, and it's an excuse for me not to bring my phone places. I can just bust out this Casio. Not only that, I'll be like, how long is this surf session going to be? I'll be like, I'm going to be out here for at least an hour. And I swear it makes the surf sessions more fun. You might be thinking, Kyle, why are you being so militant? Kyle, just enjoy yourself. Why do you need to know what time it is all the time? And let me tell you, I need to know what time it is all the time. And I want to know how long I'm doing my shit for. Is that a crime? Stop coming at me, because this Casio watch is, it's just great. It's just great, and I don't need a watch that sends me text messages. I just need one that has a little beeper on it, accurately tells me what time of day it is. Right now, it's 12:51. Whether or not it's the middle of the night or the afternoon, I will leave up to your imagination, and I think you should go out and get one, because anything to keep that little demon device that we call iPhones at bay is one step closer to being human. That's my rant for the day. And we're going to get straight on into this little podcast here. But before we do, you know, I'm going to bust out a little promo for my Substack newsletter, because this podcast isn't sponsored. So I rely on listeners like you to support it. And even if you don't have money to support Substack, you can do it for free. Just give me your email so I can stalk you and spam you. And then when you press spam, I'll figure out a way to unspam myself. And you'll just, you know, I'll be like that blue jay outside your door that just won't go away. You thought was kind of cute at first, but now you really want to leave. That's my Substack newsletter, and you can click the link below this podcast description to sign up for it. This podcast is with, I just want you guys to know, this is the weirdest I talk in my podcast intros. I don't, you guys get the weirdest version of me. That's what I'm going to keep doing. William Padilla Brown is the guest on the podcast today. And, I recorded this a few months back, but have yet to release it. It was a really enjoyable one. This guy, William, is, he's on his own path, and anyone who's on their own path is worthy to watch. Because maybe you're not into mycology, maybe that is not in your area of expertise or interest, but the way this guy sees the world, the way he thinks about the world, the way he goes after knowledge so voraciously, I think is inspiring nonetheless. And we just had a damn good conversation. So William Padilla Brown is a citizen mycologist, and he's the author of the Cordyceps Cultivation Handbook. Cordyceps are crazy little aliens. We talked about it in this podcast. And I recommend that you follow his work. He's got a great Instagram where he does little mycology tutorials on a consistent basis. I love him. I know you will too. Please give it up for William Padilla Brown.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
Well, here we are. So tell me, what was the event that you went to last night?
Yeah, so last night I did an event with the Cactus Store. I did a talk on cordyceps mushrooms. So it was called the Cordy Quest. It was mostly about my experience with cordyceps and the crazy cordyceps that I found in North America and Central America. They made this cool shirt, and there was a cool artist there named Olive that was playing music for plants after my presentation.
So what kind of music was it?
For plants.
Music for plants. So, like, yeah. She wasn't playing for the audience. She was playing for plants.
Yeah, yeah. It was vibed out. yeah, yeah.
So. Tell me more about that. Like, what kind of music was she playing?
It was very, like, ambient sounds, you know what I mean? But it definitely amplified the viewing pleasure of walking through the greenhouse. So they opened up one of their studio spaces. So the Cactus Store has, like, a proper store in, like, Echo Park area, if I'm not mistaken. And the studio is not too far from there. And they had some rare plants and things like that that they've been protecting and collecting from different estates as people pass away or can't maintain their collections and things like that. So all sorts of incredible cacti. I actually have a couple cactus buttons in the car I need to plant, so I might steal some cups from you guys.
Sure. Wait, so you said, like, if people pass away and they can't maintain their cacti, they'll give them back to this place?
No, like, this, they will get their plants, and it's not just cactus. Like, so they have a spot in LA, they also have a spot in New York City, and like I mean, they're linked up with different botanical lovers around the world that may be hosting some collection of something that may be extant or extinct or extirpated in its natural habitat. So they'll collect those plants if they can.
Oh, that's so cool.
So they've gained a quite a extensive collection, and honestly, doing God's work out here, protecting things that are sensitive in the environment are no longer in a place where we can go see them elsewhere.
And how did you get hooked up with these guys to come out to LA and do the talk last night?
So I've kind of, shouts out to my operations manager, Leslie, cause she's, booked a bunch of different gigs while I was out here specifically for, an event that we did in San Diego this past weekend at Myco Center. Shouts out Myco Center. It's like one of the coolest spots, for mycology in Southern California.
Really? Yeah. Okay. So again, is it open to the public?
Yeah. I mean, like, they definitely have hours and things like that, but they have full on, like, a store where you can go in and buy everything you need to grow mushrooms, all the cultures, all the supplies, everything like that. They also have a sick head shop called Enlightenment or Enlightened that's attached. So it's like one of the coolest facilities, like super art, like graphed out, like all sorts of mushrooms everywhere. So I was here for that event. I taught 2 days of mushroom cultivation and 1 day of specialized cordyceps cultivation. And I had linked up with the Cactus Store folks at a talk in New York City a couple weeks back. My buddy Anthony was up there giving a talk on bananas of the world. He's been traveling around the world really studying bananas. He spent a lot of time pre-pandemic, like literally like the year before the pandemic, so we're talking like 2019, traveling the South Pacific, studying all these different rare bananas that are at risk of extinction due to palm plantations.
Right.
So he documented all sorts of rare bananas, like white bananas, like highlighter yellow bananas, like all these different kind of crazy bananas.
Yeah, and yeah. Palm, for people who don't know, is a major environmental threat. Years ago, man, I was in contention for this environmental award called the Brower Youth Award, and these two girls who were Girl Scouts found out that Girl Scout cookies had palm oil in them, mm-hmm. which is basically, it's palm, and companies will just destroy rainforests to monocrop palm, which goes in a lot of the products. And it was specifically in this area, I believe it was in Borneo, where there was rare orangutans. Mm-hmm. So yeah, these two little 15-year-old girls, and they were like so compelling and cute. And then all of a sudden they just weave you into this story of Girl Scouts, palm oil, and orangutan habitat destruction.
It's a real world out there. I mean, there's like, it's a real world in real time. And every day people are, spending their dollar bills in ways that are destroying the ecology before they even know that they're part of it. So it's like this like interesting dynamic reality that's going on. So my buddy Anthony, he's been studying bananas. He's been doing incredible documentation, incredible photos. And he did a presentation at the Cactus Store in New York City. I was there. I tagged them up on Instagram. We started back and forth. I connect them with Leslie. And then we all organized this event. And it was a hit. We sold out. I talked about Cordyceps, small hold. Now they're operating here in Los Angeles. They provided mushrooms, so everybody got to, you know, take some fresh mushrooms home with them. And
what is small hold?
Small hold is a national mushroom brand, one of the emerging national mushroom brands that are supplying to grocery stores and things like this. They started out in New York City, creating like small mushroom boxes that they would have at like hotels and restaurants and stuff like that, that people could see mushrooms growing in the places that they would be buying them or eating them. And since then they've expanded into like full on production in New York City, Austin, Texas, or Buda, Texas, and then over here in Los Angeles.
What interests you specifically about Cordyceps mushrooms?
Cordyceps mushrooms, they're, I mean, everything. I mean, like, their whole order, and we're talking like taxonomic classification, like their whole order is hypocreals, which includes other parasitic fungi like ergot, which is producing interesting compounds like lysergic acid, amide. They also produce the hypocreals also includes corn smut, wheat lacoche, porn on the cob. That one is also producing interesting compounds. And then we also have fungal parasites that are newly emerged or newly evolved in that order. And then all of the insect parasitic fungus. So these fungi are producing super interesting compounds in order to interact with these organisms that they live inside of. And those compounds tend to be, you know, maybe detrimental or inhibitive of the plant or the fungus or the insect that they're parasitizing. But for us, they're like, you know, super interesting, energizing, like getting more oxygen in our body or, you know, aphrodisiac effects or all sorts of different things. So you know, finding rare novel cordyceps compounds that are inhibitive of HIV, reverse transcriptase, like super powerful, novel, natural compounds. Yeah, there's all sorts of research coming out around them. But aside from that, like just the way that they navigate through the environment in living inside of a different species, you know, taking over its muscular system. It was long thought that they took over their brains, but that's not the case. If it was, it would be even crazier.
Yeah.
You know, but they take over their muscular system, so it'd be like your like arm is like moving and you're like are like not doing it, but you don't know why your arm's moving.
Right, they'll do this to ants, right? They'll like they'll force the ants to climb up plants so that the cordyceps has better environment to grow, and then will literally spring out of the ants' heads, right?
So it's like fully like remote controlling the ant or controlling the ant like through its body, and like it blows my mind that the fungus can utilize whatever sensory functions it has to navigate through a 3-4 dimensional environment, like through another organism. So like we're talking about like a cluster of cells. Like most fungi are literally just like a network of cells that are threaded out. And like we're talking about like a network of cells living inside of another organism capable of like navigating like something's in me, like open the door, like, and walk outside. Like, the fact that it even knows how to, like, climb up a tree while it's inside of the ant is just mind-blowing to me. Like, what kind of sensory apparatus does it have that we, like, you know, we have, like, highly advanced sensory apparatus and we're still, like, bumbling around not knowing how to, like, navigate through the environment half the time, you know?
Right. It would be like if you could climb inside a redwood tree and tell the tree how to grow to your will. Like, the fact that it can communicate across species in that way is so fascinating.
Yeah, it's like, and it's, yeah, it's like, I don't even know any kind of, like analogy I could, like, anthropomorphize it with, because, like, we already see the world in three dimensions and stuff. Like, I can't really tell you that fungi do, but I can, but, like, I know through cordyceps that they do to some extent. And you know, it leads me to believe more that fungi are some, like, level of hypersentient. Yeah, so cordyceps, there's like almost every single type of insect has some sort of fungal relationship. Lots of different types of cordyceps, over 600 described species of cordyceps. Cordyceps militaris, which grows in North America, takes well to cultivation. So we've been able to grow it in mass produce these beneficial compounds that can get more oxygen into our body and give us energy. So people are using it for endurance and economic alleviation. You know, some people are growing it to, like, you know, alleviate their financial situation, produce more money, because cordyceps are worth like $600 to $800 a pound non-organic if they're domestically produced. So that's a cash crop, and there's not nearly enough domestic cordyceps. So it really, like, sparked me up from that aspect, because, like, I live in rural Pennsylvania, and, like, I oftentimes am navigating in through inner cities, and up until recently I've been teaching in mostly lower socioeconomic communities. So, like, anything I can find that's going to be like a high value product that people can grow easily, I'm just like, yo, that's the one. Like, so we can, you know, change up the situation a little bit.
Right. So just to clarify, you don't need to grow cordyceps out of insects' heads. You can also grow it domestically through other means. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. So Cordyceps militaris is one of the most successful cordyceps in the world because it grows on over 50 different species of insects. And for that reason, mostly beetles and moths and butterflies. But for that reason that it can grow on so many different types, I think that it takes well to artificial cultivation. And, like, when I say artificial cultivation, I just mean, like, non-natural forms. So we grow it on rice. Like, we grow it on brown rice, supplemented with other nutrients that you know, are help it to produce the compounds that we value in it. It's also, like, indicative of the, you know, nutritional profile of the insect. Insects are fairly nutritious.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, you mentioned that some mushrooms, a lot of mushrooms, are cash crops, and that you want to get this information out to more people and show them, hey, this isn't just something that's good for you. It's actually a way that you can make some money. And that was, if I'm correct, the way that you got into all of this, right? Like, you bought some gear for a few bucks, and then all of a sudden you were able to sell it for more. Will you just walk people a little bit through that origin story of how you got involved in mushroom cultivation?
Yeah, so I was already practicing permaculture design whenever I got more interested into mushroom cultivation, and I had some experience I could lean on from my teenage years playing around with, you know, little tubs of mushrooms at the ends of my bed, at the end of my bed, and stuff like that. I started to cultivate mushrooms in my basement, like gourmet mushrooms, oyster mushrooms, lion's mane, reishi. I think those were the few that I started out with. I got little cultures in the mail and syringes. And I started growing them in, like, a little, like, 4x4 or 2x4, like, hydroponic grow tent. Excuse me, sorry.
Hey, you good?
But yeah, I was like, I used to work part time at a hydroponic store whenever I was working on liberating myself from the colonial zombie. So I got discounts at this hydro store to get equipment and stuff like that. So I got the grow tent, put it in my basement, and I started growing mushrooms in there. And at this time in my life, I was serving tables, and I also had a baby. I was like 21, 20, something like that, living with my girl. And I couldn't really afford all this kind of stuff, like hobbies and stuff like that. Those are luxuries of people that can afford it. And even though I wanted to approach it as a business, like, if it wasn't producing money, it's a hobby. You know what I mean? So, like, I couldn't really convince anybody that it was anything more than that, because nobody really saw the vision until it really was, like, productive. But what I was able to do there was cultivate enough mushrooms in that space to afford the equipment necessary to buy more equipment. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I was able to fund the first initial purchase. Then I was able to produce more, buy a little bit more, and expand from there. And that's really how I built up my business with mushrooms. And then I really just took advantage of the trends. So I was doing all sorts of other things because of the economic situation I was in. I was cultivating most of my food. I was a vegan at this point, so it was really easy. I was cultivating, foraging, collecting spring water to reduce, you know, purchasing water that I was bringing into my house. Collecting rainwater for my garden so I didn't have a high water bill. Growing algae for supplementation of, like, any nutrients that I was missing out on. Had chickens in the backyard. Like, literally all these different things I was doing to, like, just, like, alleviate the economic stresses of the world. But I really started, and I was posting it all on the internet. because I figured, you know, I'm a child of the internet era. I was born in 94, you know. A lot of really crazy things happened for the internet in 94. But I've been on the internet my whole life. I've been on YouTube since 2006, 7, like actually posting stuff on there. So like, it was just like second nature to be posting what I was doing. And like all the mushroom stuff was like trending more than anything else. So I was like, all right, that's the moves. I just amplified on the mushroom work that I was doing, put more of that stuff on the internet, and incorporated mycosymbiotics in 2015 when I was, 23, I think. Yeah.
Did you have...
I was 21.
Okay.
Yeah, I was 21. I feel proud about that, so I just want to throw that out
there. Fuck yeah, you should be. It's incredible. I'm so fascinated as to where this conversation's about to go. You're an interesting cat. Who got you into permaculture? Did you have any mentors or people early on that paved the way for you in that way?
Yeah, so... I was like super tripped out. I don't know if I mentioned, but I dropped out of high school when I was 16. I was living in an apartment in Pennsylvania and we had our kid. And I was just like tripping, like, and like everybody thought I was like lost my mind. Everybody thought I was a lost cause. My family was trying to figure out like how, like what to do about
you're tripping, the situation. Just like doing a lot of psychedelics.
Yeah. I was like tripped out, like barefoot, like shaved head, like meditating all the time, like crystals in hand, like burning incense and stuff. Like nobody knew how to relate to me,
right?
Like, and I didn't care to be relatable, you know. Everybody was trying to like anchor me to the world in some way, especially because I had a young child to be mindful of. And really in my mind, what I was doing was for my family. And this was like when my girl was pregnant. And so like, this was like, everybody was like really trying to like help us figure out. And my girl's mom was the only one that was like more leaning towards like, all right, let's like try and go with their interests instead of trying like make them fit in. 'Cause like my parents were like join the military, like figure, like try and go back to school, go to the community college. Like they're like all these different kinds of things that was just like not for me.
Yeah. They were worried.
Yeah. Sure. They were worried. I mean, my dad was in the army. My mom worked for the government her whole life. So like, they were like very safe, like decisions. And like my mom's Catholic and stuff. So like everything was just like really bizarre, like the lifestyle choices that I had decided to take.
Just before we get into that, I want to talk a little bit more about that state. So how did you get into, you know, tripping on psychedelics on, sounds like, a semi-regular basis or very regular basis?
I was on a routine of taking mostly LSD on a
bi-weekly basis.
Yeah, massive doses of LSD on a bi-weekly basis. And I wouldn't do it if I couldn't understand what happened in the experience before. So like if one experience was like overwhelmingly like bizarre and like I'm trying to like decode what's going on or like decipher how I'm feeling, I won't go for that one on the next couple weeks, because then it would just make everything even more bizarre and like it would take me even longer to try and figure out what the heck happened.
Right.
So
how would you like define what was being how would you define that the experience was decoding something for you?
Because I would see visual hallucinations or whatever you would call. I mean, like, I think the word hallucinations makes people think that it's like not real, but sure. I would see visual, stimuli that would be patterns. And if I could understand what the pattern was, then I would see it whenever I wasn't tripping. And the first patterns that I ever saw when I first started tripping were, when I first figured out what it was. It was leaves turning into soil in the ground on the forest. I never knew that happened my whole life. It was something I never saw my whole life. I felt like a baby. I felt like a baby born in a world. I don't know shapes. I don't know color. Everything is just fucking weird looking. Yeah. You know what I mean? You have to like to figure out what you relate to what you're seeing consciously. And I never went to nature in my whole life. My parents never took me out into the forest to go hiking. I didn't go surfing. I didn't go fishing. I didn't go boating. I didn't, none of that stuff. My mom's literally like afraid of the forest. And like my dad was just so busy working that it was like never a time for that. And my parents were split up. So like, I just like lived in cities. I started traveling on airplanes when I was like 7 by myself. So I spent a lot of time playing like video games, Game Boy, stuff like that. So like by the time I was 18, nature was like forests and all that stuff was just like a blurry thing I saw out the window of a fast moving vehicle. So like when I went out into it, it was all something I didn't recognize. And like it was all patterns and visual hallucinations and stimuli and shit like that. So like I'm sitting out in the forest, all my friends are just like, oh haha, like look at all these patterns and stuff. And I'm just like sitting there, I'm like, no, this is something. Like this is literally something. And like I'm looking at it, I'm like, wow, the leaves turn into soil. And I'm like, holy shit. And then like after I saw that, then I just knew it. And I'm like, the more I like look at these patterns and understand what I'm looking at, the more I can understand what is real, because all the shit that I came out of in the city, I could tell more and more as I was looking in nature that the stuff in the city was made up by people. Like somebody made it up, and it was mostly like dudes that have bad ideas, because like in the Western cultures, we say West like we still live in Europe, they just give their women freedom in like the 60s and shit. So like mostly dudes made up these terrible ass ideas that I've been living in my whole life. And then like I'm just like, yo, what is this world that I don't know anything about? So like that's what I was really doing whenever I was in there. And like also mental patterns and things like that, because like my routines and like even the language that I was using was all created by other people that didn't have my best interests in mind. So I was like really trying to figure out my own mind, my own body, and it was all just like puzzles and patterns. And like when I was younger, my mom was in college, my dad was living in New York City, and I grew up with my grandparents for the first like 4 years of my life, like very like formative years, and they were academics. My grandfather was the first African-American English professor in New York City at Megar Evers University in Brooklyn, and he brought me up with like purpose. Like he was like, we are Black, like people like us don't know how to speak as well as we do. I'm going to transfer this information to you, and you're going to take care of our family. You're going to be the first one in our family that has the freedom to utilize this tool in a way that we didn't have before, because I wasn't allowed to speak the way that you'll be able to speak. He told me shit like that all the time when I was younger. And like, I knew it. I was like, yeah, I'm going to be the one for our family. Like that kind of shit, like made me feel like invigorated. But like my grandparents were also like, don't watch the TV. It's the boob tube. Like you'll lose your mind. Like you'll become a boob if you watch the TV. Like, and like they made me do puzzles and like play Scrabble and like all this different kind of things that when I started tripping, I was like, oh shit, like this is all puzzles and patterns. You know what I mean? Like fucking riddles and shit. You know what I mean? Like literally my first trip.
You're like Neo in the Matrix.
Facts, bro. Like just blessed up by the sages. Like, and like my first trip, like no shit. Like my whole life, my grandfather, I swear to God, he knew he was going to die before I was a man. Like the way he talked to me was like I was a man, and I didn't always understand what he was saying. One of my first really intense trips, I straight up talked to a dead man. Like I talked to my grandfather, and it was like I realized at some point in it, I was like, damn, I'm having the conversations that he had with me that I didn't understand what he was saying, but I heard it. I was there. You know what I mean? Like, so like, it's in there. Like you can like tap into memories, like all different kinds of things like that. So I was just like really navigating this reality. My dad was living in Afghanistan. My mom was living in Taiwan. I'm living by myself. Nobody's telling me what to do. Like I could just go as far out as I wanted to be. And like in those places, I found a lot of information that was very valuable.
Right. You mentioned that your grandfather put a lot of emphasis on how you spoke and using knowledge and your ability to convey ideas eloquently. He really imbued that as a superpower.
Mm-hmm. A gift. Yeah.
What would he do to, like, were there lessons or like tips or anything that he would tell you that specifically resonated with you? Because you do have a really powerful way of speaking.
Yeah, they made me journal. They made me write about what I did every single day at the end of the day. It's like they had me talking like ASAP. Like I was talking like 1 year old, writing like all this kind of stuff. They're talking to me like prefixes, suffixes, like before I was even in preschool type stuff. And like they wrote the stories that I read at night. Like they would read me stories at nighttime. They wrote it and they drew the pictures in it. Like straight up, it wasn't even just like some handmade stuff. Like they printed books. Like my grandparents both wrote books. Like, and like they would read me that stuff, and like it was like for me, like it was like for me and my cousins, like they specifically Like, I felt like I was born into angels. Like, I felt like I was born into, like, a really safe, like, experience of people that were giving me blessings. Like, all they did every day was give me blessings. Like, my grandma cooked me food. She showed me how she was doing it. I'm sitting there in the kitchen with her. My grandfather's, like, reading me these books, telling me stories about his life, and, like, literally just giving me so many gifts. Like, and I feel like I just want to give that to so many people that I meet that, like, didn't have that in their life. You know what I mean? Because I see so many people in this world that it's just, like, I feel like they never got love before and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like, so, like, I interact with so many people. So I try and, like, in the way that I teach and the way that I interact with people, like, convey those gifts.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people have the knowledge that something is deeply wrong, but they don't know how to articulate it. And it's one of the most frustrating human experiences, mm-hmm. when you know something in your body, but you can't find the words to express it. Mm-hmm. So I do think that it's a real gift when someone like you can speak that kind of truth, because then a lot of people are like, that's fucking exactly what I wanted to say. Mm-hmm. But you need to, you need to do that kind of, those kinds of lessons. And I really identify with what you're saying, man. I mean, I used to have a reoccurring dream. It was one of the only reoccurring dreams I've ever had, where I couldn't speak. Like, it was like the Neo from the Matrix thing, yeah. where the thing goes over his mouth, mm-hmm. and it was the most maddening, fucking frustrating, and like, and it was almost nonverbal, which is ironic, but just mm-hmm. like that feeling of claustrophobia. And the feeling of having an idea that I could express in my body, but not through my mouth.
Yeah.
And it's honestly informed a lot of my career, just that feeling. And you know, because I didn't really grow up as a reader. Mm-hmm. And then once I realized that that was going to be the necessary bridge between ending that kind of frustration, that kind of deep frustration, mm-hmm. that was really when I started to build that habit and focus pretty intensely on reading and writing and speaking.
Yeah, these are very critical skills to have in this era or this age that we live in, where we're bombarded with information. And you'd be surprised at how many people are lacking in those skills. You know, I traveled around with my mother growing up, whenever I was 10 years old, she let me move to go live with my father, who traveled more domestically. My mother traveled internationally. So I went from going to a private school in Kensington, London, very well off, like literally world leaders' kids going to these schools and stuff like that, because the government would pay for our education when we were in different countries. And my mom was like, yo, we're running it up. I'm about to give my kids the best education ever. You know what I mean? And like, I went from that school to a school in rural Pennsylvania where I live now. And I went from learning about world religions and robotics to kids that didn't know how to read at all. And they were the same age as me. And those kids are the same friends that are of mine that are like, you know, I had this one trip with one of my friends that grew up in a trailer park, still lives in a trailer park back in rural Pennsylvania. And he told me, like, he was freaking out in this trip, and he's like, I think so many things and I don't know how to say them like you know how to say what you think. And he's like, I don't even know what to do about it. And I was like, dude, I feel for you, bro. Like, I all I can do is hang out with people and just like be and like just exist and like, you know, transfer and teach and like all these kinds of things. But it's super real. And, you know, just to bring it back to the story that start where it started, I'm geeked out. Everybody's wondering what's going on, trying to help me out. And my girl's mom, she's like a little bit more hippie leaning. Like, my girl's mom's not like hippie by any means, but like she hangs out with a bunch of hippie people back where we live. And she's like, some of my friends are like gardening and teaching classes in this at this house in Camp Hill. You should go connect with them. Like, that's all she told me. She told me where to go, and that was it. Cause like I was gardening and stuff. Like, I'd be meditating, I'd be tripped out. I'd come out from meditating in the attic. I would literally go to work, be meditating in the attic, like super geek. Like, I would like make my own hash, get as high as I could, be like fucking tripping on L, doing Merkaba meditations, practicing breathing techniques, like all these different kind of shit. I'm like fucking 18, 19. Like, this is like still not even, people are just figuring shit like breathing and meditating out where I live. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And so like, I'm like literally in like astral realms, like metaprogramming the human biocomputer, like operating as consciousness, having out-of-body experiences, like pulling out McDonald's programming and like Nike programming out of my brain. I'm like, you don't belong here. Like, this is fucking private property. Like, this is not, like, you know what I mean? Like, how did you even implant yourself in my fucking young adolescent mind and fucking all these damn commercials and shit? It's like the most tantalizing shit ever, just flashing in your eyes all the goddamn time when you're little. Like, so, like, I'm, like, pulling all this shit out of my brain, like cleaning it up, sweeping, you know what I mean? Like, making sure that it's set up the way that I want it to be. And then I'll come out and be gardening. So, because I was like, yo, if I'm cleaning out my temple, I'm not going to put some bullshit back in there. Like, you know what I mean? I travel around with my mom. My mom works for the USDA Foreign Affairs. I know how the global trade system could be dirty as fuck. Like good on the global trade system for feeding the world. But there's better ways to do this shit. So, like, I'm like, I'm not putting bad food in there. So, I'll grow my own food. I'll eat my own food. I'll grow my own medicine. I take my own medicine. And, like, I would literally, like, not consume music, not consume TV for, like, a couple years. I would just put my feet on the ground, go outside into nature. I'm like, I don't even know where this music's coming from. I don't know what production company is putting out, what their message is. I don't know where the show's produced by, who's the director, all this kind of stuff. I don't know what their intention is. I'm just like, I'm not even going to watch nothing until I know what I'm consuming. And, like, now I've been out here. I've been traveling around the world my whole life. I know Viacom. I know Sony. I know all this kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Like, so, like, I understand what I'm consuming more than when I was a young kid and I didn't know what was all coming in my head. So I go to that backyard and they're doing permaculture. And it looked like the most righteous shit I ever seen in my whole life. I'm like, because I'm tripped out and, like, everything in the human world looked, like, fucked up. Like, literally, like, demons and stuff. And, like, I go in this dude's backyard and for the first time I see something that people made out of their own ideas that looks right, that looks like healthy. And I'm just like, what is this? Like, what is this thing that humans created that's like, that's good? Like, cause I've been in this world where humans are like fucking each other up, like in bad ways. And like, there's like gardens and it's like sustainable and there's compost. And I'm just like, I don't understand what I'm looking at, but I know it feels good. And then I met my friend Seppi Garrett, who introduced me to Benjamin Weiss, who became my permaculture instructor, and I took a permaculture apprenticeship in that backyard while my girl was pregnant. My kid was literally born one of the days while I was taking the apprenticeship. I couldn't even go. That's how I learned about permaculture. And then I took, which was then the most affordable permaculture design course in North America, in Harrisburg. I couldn't even afford it back then still. So somebody sponsored me to go there. It was like $500. I literally was making like $700 every 2 weeks, like trying to raise a kid and shit like that. And somebody sponsored me to go there, and that shit changed my whole life. I learned permaculture design. It was like the tools that I needed to like design the life that is sustainable. And if it's really sustainable, like if you really do permaculture design the right way and it's really sustainable, then you'll be able to sustain your life. Like that's as simple as
yeah.
In
theory, that's kind of permaculture, right?
Yeah.
That's...
In theory, I mean, if you're practicing it the right way, like there's so many people that's like caught up in like the Babylon and like the colonial zombie, which has us like viewing time in a microscopic way where we're looking at minutes and hours and stuff like that all the time. A lot of people don't have that. Like a lot of people can't afford the time to do permaculture design the right way, because you have to really be able to like see long temporal systems and design around them. But if you're living in the cities all the time, how are you supposed to know that the trees are moving and stuff? Like that's why it's like the biggest trip that people have. If you talk across the board, people are like, oh, I started tripping and the trees were like breathing. Like mad people say that. And they'll be like, yo, the trees were like alive. We're just like, they're fucking alive all the time.
The you trees I mean? Were alive, yeah. Yeah. That is a funny statement. You're like, no, you just weren't paying attention.
That's what I'm saying, but you'd be moving, yeah. People be moving so fast. That was literally the enlightenment of Siddhartha. Like the Buddha, he sat under the Bodhi tree until he saw that the trees were like also alive. Like most people at that point in history had never sat like that long in a way that they could even like perceive and describe it to others. Like those kinds of things are like enlightened thoughts. Like if you went to the top of the mountain when everybody was living at the bottom of the mountain and you were the first one in history to do that shit and you're like, you know, this is what life is like. Like,
yeah,
people would be like, oh God, like, how did you know that? Like, that's real. That's truth. I can see that that's truth. But like, I never seen life from above, so I don't even know. But like, yeah. Now we got all these like things going on where we can see all these different types of things.
I think that meditation and journaling are two of the best tools to deprogram yourself from, you know, what you call the colonial zombie.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about this more because, you know, I I very much straddle these two worlds, right? Of advertising and also feeling like I want to tear down the man. Mm-hmm. And it's been interesting for me to understand that, you know, advertising is just programming. It's mm-hmm. just getting ideas, usually in the form of words and design, out into culture that make people think certain thoughts and certain sentences inside their own mind and get them to identify in certain ways that get them to ultimately change behavior, mm-hmm. right? And just the fact that you recognize, no, that's actually a choice. You know, I think that there are, you know, there are companies that are certainly a lot more evil than others. You know, like you're talking about, like McDonald's programming, like program that tells you that you are, that you should be doing this thing, but really it's shortening your life as you're doing it. But just the idea that you always have that choice of whether or not you want to accept that thought that's being projected at you, I think it's incredibly profound. And one thing that I really like about Mudwater is that it is a huge amount of our thrust is just getting people to question their habits.
Mm-hmm.
Like Shane's thing, like fuck your coffee, right? Like he mm-hmm. got that from a sticker at Burning Man that was fuck your burn.
Yeah.
And people just throw these stickers all over Burning Man. It was like, fuck your burn. Because if you feel that, like, what? Like, no. That feeling of offense,
yeah.
that's the first step in you trying to defend this thing that you really believe in.
Mm-hmm.
But just by, like, poking that bee's nest a little bit,
yep.
it's getting you to reorient potentially and question your relationship with that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that humor's ultimate when it comes to getting people to question their relationship with, you know, these things that they find holy. And I think that process that you're talking about of journaling and of meditating and of actually taking space to, as you said, like clean out your temple, you know, there is a path, and there are habits and tools that you can incorporate into your life that allow you to recognize the thoughts that you're thinking and become more durable in the face of this onslaught of ideas that are coming at you at all times.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want you to talk a little bit about those practices, specifically meditation and journaling, and how you would get to deciding what thoughts you wanted to carry around with you as you were going through this change in your life.
Well, journaling has come in and out of my life as, like, you know, whatever phases I'm in. There are certain routines that stick longer than others. Journaling I find to be very helpful for remembering things, especially as, like, everything's getting expansive and life just keeps going. But the meditation was super helpful because for so long I had been living in a world of just, like, accepting information in but not really, like, looking in. Like, I'm so much external stimulation, but not internal. So it really just, like, gives you a moment to, like, check yourself and check your, like, impulses and things like this. Like, so, like, you know, a lot of people will sit for a while, especially nowadays, and then they won't be able to sit that long before they're, like, starting to, like, twitch and fidget and, like, all these kinds of things. But it's, like, why, you know what I mean? Like, so, like, that's really what it, like, that's really what it got down to for me. Cause, like, before, when I was younger, I'd be like biting my cheek, like shaking my leg, like, you know what I mean, like doing all this stuff, like chewing some gum, like fucking doing all these things, like, you know, I've been through the whole gambit of it. But it was just like, why? Like, you know what I mean? Like, what's going on? All right, like, let's assess it and you know, run through it. So I feel like it's like a self-diagnostic almost. Like, I teach a class or do this presentation in more of like a psychedelic space called Metaprogramming the Human Biological Computer. These are ideas brought to us by John C. Lilly amplified by the work of Kalindi, the late Kalindi. who like suggested 30 gram doses of psilocybin and to reprogram your brain. John C.
It'll do something to your brain, that's for sure.
John C. Lilly.
For people who don't know, like a 5 gram psilocybin trip is considered a heroic dose.
Yeah, it's considered heroic. I also think that our like frame of like mind. All right, so like I was just in like San Jose del Pacifico and I met an 8-year-old kid that like tripped out. Like,
I've been there. Yeah,
like, you know
yeah.
what I mean? And like it was chilling and like it's chilling for everybody. And I'm like not suggesting that everybody go do this, but we live in whole different realities. But like a lot of it is like cultural. Like that 5 gram dose is like a contemporary dose, right? Like this is a dose that will affect a human that has been exposed to the colonial zombie their whole life. So, like, you've been using English, you've been watching TV, you've been going to school, you've been following the government, you've been in your nation, you haven't traveled. Like, all of those things impact the experience that you have, where 5 grams or a gram might make you just, like, lose your fucking brains because you were watching SpongeBob your whole life. But, like somebody that's taking the time to, like, you know, read more and expose themselves to more things and try more things, maybe try learning a different language, trying different foods and things like that. The experience may be a whole lot different where, like, you might need a couple more grams, but it's also, like, you know, biochemical. So, like, your mental chemistry, whether or not you're taking SSRIs, whether or not you've been on Adderall, whether or not you took Ritalin when you were little, whether or not, like, you have some sort of predisposition or, like, you know, whatever we're calling, like, schizophrenia, bipolar, all these different things. Those can all also play and come into play, but if we're talking about just, like, regular healthy people, the culture that you're in is a big effect. So like Ram Dass, Timothy Leary, they went to the East, and like I always say, like the East and the West, we're not in Europe anymore, we're in North America. So east of us is Africa and in Europe, west of us is Asia, but like we talk about this like we're from Europe. So I'm gonna keep with that for now, but I implore people to stop doing that shit. But the Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, they went to these Asian countries and they literally met with like the last carriers of the torch of like the traditions that we've brought over here, like meditation and yoga and all these kinds of things, and they gave them the psychedelics, and a lot of them were just like not even fazed by it. Like a lot of them have been meditating up in the mountains, like eating vegan food, like really focused on self, and they're just like, yeah, this is not really anything. And then some of them will be like, this is as close to death as you can get without dying. And that was like a common occurrence. Like a lot of like enlightened beings or meditated martial artists and all these kinds of things that they gave the psychedelics to would either not be fazed by it or would say, this is death, but you're still alive. And like that was really common kind of thing. So I think that it is very cultural what you do, what your environment is, how it affects you. You know, I've met people that straight up take a lot and just like nothing.
Yeah, well, even if you just think about the way your brain patterns are changing when you're on a drug like psilocybin, it's putting you on a right trip. It's putting you in a more meditative state. And if you think about a hunter-gatherer culture where, let's say, most of your time is out in the forest, keenly paying attention to your surroundings, not context shifting from one task to the next task all day long, your brain's going to be more set up to take on those patterns. Okay, so it makes sense that it will feel more normal to someone like that than someone who's, you know, been a careerist their whole life, you know, hopping from company to company, thinking on a minute by minute or hour by hour timescale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's like, that's entirely what I'm saying. Like it's really going to affect people differently. So that 30 gram, like people might be like, oh my God, like, whoa. But like for some people that might be like exactly what they need. But like I'm talking about like, you know, metaprogramming the human biological computer. I can't necessarily remember why I brought up that idea, but like it's the idea of like using, like recognizing yourself as a conscious operator of your body. And then like from that framework, like choosing your routines and taking more authority and intention into your decisions. You know, so many people never take that opportunity to take a step back. And like, that's what I think that meditation really allows us to do. They're just like a player in the movie. Like they're just like subjected to their own life and like the actions that happen in the day, like based off of all the decisions that came before. But at any point we can take that step back and be like, okay, well, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do this. And, you know, start.
Yeah, I mean, it also sounds like you, from what I'm gathering of your childhood, is you were exposed to some people who really taught you how to take on healthy habits and taught you how, like, the discipline of learning, mm-hmm. right? Before psychedelics came into your life, because what I've seen happen more often than I freaking wish I would have is that people start taking a bunch of psychedelics and they'll be like, oh, I'm having these great insights, but they won't make any changes to their lives. Mm-hmm. And in some cases it can be really dangerous because they sort of lose their tether to this world mm-hmm. and become inoperable. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's, that's why psychedelics should be taken with great care and reverence and respect. And that's also why I was continuing to come back to the fact that it sounded like you had meditation and journaling and these learning practices so that you could take the insights and then actually incorporate them back into your day-to-day existence pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I did get some healthy habits from my family. I also gained a lot of unhealthy habits, like most of us do. I mean, I grew up on a lot of oatmeal cream pies and lies, like, just like I said. You know, I grew up, like, religious heavy. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with the religions, but, like, it wasn't necessarily my fit. And you know, the dad in the military, like, drilling a lot of those, like, military ethics in and stuff like that. So, like, it wasn't always the best. I definitely, part of the psychedelic experience was, like, fixing my body because my stomach never worked right. Like, I, like, dealt with all sorts of constipation and issues and things like that literally until I started smoking weed when I was, like, younger. Started working on my diet, changing my eating habits, because I didn't know how to eat, what to eat, all these different kinds of things. So it took me a while to figure out, like, my body likes this and, like, this much of this, and, like, I can handle this, because, like, every body is different. We all grow up on, like, this, like, food pyramid ass, like, everybody should eat the same thing, like, wow.
Yeah, milk's a fucking bomb for your stomach.
Yeah, it's just like, it's all variant, like, you know, like, it's all, like, I mean, it's genetics based, it's individual based, especially now when a lot of our bodies are so mixed up. So, like, for a long period of time, like, our families may have been in this one region eating this one thing, but, like, now we're, like, the whole way across the world and mixed with another genetic from, like, a different person from around the world and, like, all this kind of stuff. So, like, we have to really learn ourselves, like, what foods make us feel what way and navigate that way. So, like, that was, like, a lot of what the psychedelic experience was. But yeah, navigating these different modalities has been super helpful in incorporating into my life. A lot of that came through the exploration of world religions, esoteric knowledge and different modalities, which got me into doing different types of meditations from Hebrew traditions and from Tibetan traditions, as well as Egyptian traditions, and chanting and utilizing mantras in Aramaic, Sanskrit, Tibetan, Egyptian, and Hebrew, which through research I discovered were the five most recent languages utilized to communicate with, like, angelic entities and things like that, which I find some value to. So, like, in historic documentation through religious text, like, this many thousands of years ago, this messenger talked to an angel or whatever. Like, the language that they were using, I think, is important. We're using war language. English right now is a Latin-based war language that is not even that much Latin-based in the sense that, like, I don't know if you've ever heard, but English is one of the more difficult languages to learn because we use a lot of...
I still feel like I barely know it.
Right? We use a lot of words that we stole from people that we conquered their land. And we were just like trampling through all these different places. English speaking people, when I say we, trampling through all these different places, and they're like, oh, this is these people's culture. This is what they call that thing. We don't even have a word for it. We're going to call it what they call it, incorporate it into English. Like, that happens so fast and so quickly, and the English language has diverged so far from its from the conquest that it is one of the more difficult languages to use. And it hasn't really looked at emotions, and it also hasn't really looked at nature, because English people were afraid as fuck of nature. Mostly with the Roman Catholicism, were against paganism, thought that anybody that understood nature was a witch, thought that mushrooms are fucking demonic. That's part of the reason why we're just starting to study all of this kind of thing. We literally don't have the words to describe it.
I was reading an article about how we have so many more words for negative emotions than positive emotions. Like, you know, we have... it's a really interesting article about how words shape our perception, and when you have more negative words or ways to describe negative emotions than positive emotions, you're more likely to feel them more often. Mm-hmm. Because when you can name something, then all of a sudden you can feel it more deeply.
Yeah, and most of the reason why our brain grew this big is because of language and communication skills. And there's whole cultures that don't even have words for things like time or for other. So, like, if you don't know how to describe other, like, what is your perception of reality? If you don't have words to describe time passing by, like, what is your perception of reality? So I think these things are very powerful. And
it's Terence McKenna, right? Our world is made of words. Mm-hmm. That's what codes are what we see.
Mm-hmm. So I do believe in, like, through modern research with cymatics, binaural beats, and things like that, we do understand that different tones and frequencies have different effects on our brain, as well as water and things like this, which we're mostly made of. So there are ancient cultures that have understood this in the way that they chant and the way that their mouths move when the words come out, actually, like, creates formations and vibrations. And we still utilize these today, like the Om.
Yeah, mentioning the mantras. So mm-hmm. There's the book Breath by James Nestor. He talks about how there was a study where they brought in various religions and they would all do their mantras, and it was a perfect, they all lined up as 5.5 seconds in, 5.5 seconds out, mm-hmm. which is apparently the best breath that you can have is at that time. So all these different religions have their mantras that are making people breathe in this perfect pattern.
Yeah, I mean, and like this is like before humans were locked into microscopic time, you could only imagine what one had the ability to discover. You know, there are so many stories of enlightened ones or prophets or people that predicted the future, you know, sitting in a cave for 10 years or, you know, going into the forest for 10 years or something like that. Like, who the fuck can afford that? Like, some rich people,
right,
maybe?
Right. You know what I'm saying? I was wondering what you meant by microscopic time, but just that, like, I have three meetings today.
I got to look at the hours. And, like, yeah. there was points in time where humans could literally just be in nature, and, like the only scales of time that you are looking at is when the fruit falls off the tree or, like, when, like, the snow comes. Like, so, like, your perception of time is literally, like, expansive and more based on actual real things than, like, 9 to 5, like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, so, and, like, just to bring it back and to, like, wrap up the idea, so that it's done there, but the psychedelic experience and the meditative experience, and combined with the mantras and eating different, like I was going through in that phase where I was changing from a product of the colonial zombie to self-recognition, self-actualization, community actualization, and generational actualization, that happened because psychedelics give us a effect of distortion of space and time. That is a known effect of these substances. So because I couldn't afford the cave for 10 years, I could afford that 10 strip of LSD that would give me the ability to perceive time differently and to meditate and to really, you know, take effect, be most effective with that. So, like, most people are taking these substances at, like, a rave, at a party, is like flashing lights, lots of stimulation, all these kinds of things, wonder why they don't get the same kind of enlightenment. I'm taking these substances. I'm literally meditating, studying all these ancient mantras, mudras, like not just because I believe that their God is right or their philosophy is right. They did something with their body that made them have some sort of profound experience. They did something with their mouth, with their vibrations, with their mind that made them have some sort of profound experience. So I'm just like, let's compile these different experiences. Let me upload all these different operating systems into my biological computer, see which ones are effective, utilize these different mechanisms to create routines that are effective for this contemporary experience with this body. That's what I did in that time. And then I made my business after that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's get into that chapter now. So what was there a day or a moment that, like, what was different about the day that got you to that particular day that got you to cultivate those mushrooms? You maybe had the thought before, and I think that a lot of people, they might have a thought like, oh, I could do that, but most of them never do. Do you remember what was different about that got you to actually go buy the stuff and then take that next step and the next step and the next step?
So when I was, like, a teenager, like, when I was young and I grew, like, the first little experiments with mushrooms, it was, like, because I found out that that the mushrooms I was eating were grown on animal manure, and like people were selling them trying to get the most weight on it, so they'd left the manure stuck to the bottom. Yeah. I'm just like, and all my friends were like, yeah, eat all the dust in the bottom of the bag, it'll get you all geek, whatever. And I'm just like, ew. Like, yeah, I found out on the internet later, I'm just like, gross, that's so nasty. So I'm like, all right, I'm gonna grow my own, I'm gonna trim them up nice, you know what I mean, I'm gonna make sure they're clean. Like, I don't know if this motherfucker had like cats in their house. Like, I'd be getting weed sometimes when I was younger, and there'd be like cat hair all on it and yeah, stuff like that. And I'm just like, yo, I don't know. Like, that's weird. Like, they're following like the OSHA standards. Like, you know what I mean? They have serve safe. Like, you know what I mean? Like, nobody's doing that shit. When
that's funny. I mean, I remember the exact same thing happened at my high school where like some kids would sell weed and they'd literally like throw some grass in it to like make it more weight. I'm like, wait, I feel like a lot of big companies still do this right? shit.
Like, they'd be cutting
corners. I mean, they do. Like, learning about, you know, the mushroom industry and all the fucking shenanigans out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just people throwing grass in their weed.
Yeah.
Try and sell it for more. It's wild.
Yeah, people really do be diluting stuff. So like, that's what initially got me to grow my first mushroom. So I was like, all right, fuck that. Like, I really value this experience, but I don't want to be eating nasty stuff. I literally I don't have no bread. Like, I don't have any money. I can't afford it. So like, growing it's the best bet I have. So, you know, I did that. And then later on, after I had went to the permaculture, like, apprenticeship and everything like that, I signed up for the permaculture course. I'm like, yo, I've invested like over $1,000 into non-traditional education. Like, I've been taking these classes from different people. It's way more affordable than going to college. But like, I'm like, there's these people out here. Like, I'm one of 20 people in the class. I paid like $50. Like, I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, yo, these people out here making a living teaching people life skills. And I'm just like, I know how to do something that nobody else knows how to do. Literally, I'm looking on the internet. Nobody, I live in like Central Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania touches more states than any other state. 40% of the U.S. population can drive to where I live in a day. Like, New York City, Philly, Pittsburgh, D.C., Baltimore. Those are all within, like, 3 hours drive. Like, some of them are, like an hour and a half. So, like, I'm just like, how come nobody in all of this space can teach about mushrooms? This is, like, in, like, 2014. Like, I was, 2013, 2014, I'm the only one. I'm just like, no way. So like, I started offering mushroom classes. At first, like, maybe 2-3 people will come. But like, eventually, more and more people started to come. And like, that's initially what like led me to start growing mushrooms. Like, I'm in the permaculture class. I'm like, what can I do that nobody else is doing? I'm like, all right, like, mushrooms fit into this. Like, I see mushrooms in the permaculture gardens. Like people want to eat mushrooms. People are talking about medicinal mushrooms. They don't know where to get them. They literally don't know what they're talking about. And like, my limited experience I had from growing them when I was a teenager is more than everybody else has. So I just amplified on that. And I just started growing like gourmets, medicinals, all the things that I thought that like anybody would find beneficial. You know what I mean? So like, started running that up, and that's why I started growing mushrooms for this time that's turned into my business.
Okay. And was there a time then when your parents were like, oh man, this could be something? Because it sounded like they were pretty worried about you.
Yeah.
for your seeking phase.
Yeah. It was in like 2015. Yeah, it was in 2015 that my parents were like, okay, maybe there's something to this. Because like, I had done the permaculture classes. I had like been growing food and like basically farming. Like, at that point, they were like, okay, Will's probably gonna be a farmer or something. So like, I'd been like growing food and like growing mushrooms and like this stuff for like a couple years. I had stuck with it. And then in 2015, I incorporated my business, Mycosymbiotics. And then I was talking to my parents and I was like, hey guys, I really want to do something with my life. Like, this is really what I want to do. If like you could ever help me with anything, like, please help me with this shit. Cause like, when I was younger, my parents used to be like, yeah, go to college and all this kind of stuff. But like, by the time I got there, it was like not even a reality. And like, my family couldn't afford to like send me to college. And like I also couldn't afford to take a debt on, like, because if I took a debt on, then that's me relying on my family more for different things. And like, so like, I just was like, all right, that's off the table. But I'm like, yo, if you guys can help me to do this, I can take care of my kid. Like, just like, I won't ask you guys for nothing anymore. Because like, I don't know, shit wasn't sweet like where I come from. Like it was like, I don't know. I meet so many people that just like got a car when they're 16 and like, you know, their parents got them to go to a nice college. And like when they wanted to start a business, like their uncle gave them some money to like, that shit wasn't real for me. You know what I mean? So like all this shit was like also like out of necessity. So I'm just, and like, I used to rely on my, like, I'd be like stuck in Pennsylvania serving tables and like the check doesn't come in good one week. And I'm just like, yo, I gotta get diapers for my kid. I'm like, yo, mom, like, can you help me out? Like, dad, can you help me out type shit? And I'm just like, yo, I will be able to take care of my family if you help me learn about this stuff. Like, if you help me figure out what I need to get my business started. So, like, I asked them to send me to Fungi for the People, which was a class in Oregon. There was two classes. Both were a week long. One was on mushroom cultivation. The other one was on mycoremediation. So in 2015, like right after I started my business, like, my dad bought me the plane ticket. My mom bought me the course tickets. And, like, I flew out to Oregon. And that shit changed my life. Like, I met a bunch of anarchists. I met a bunch of, like, real-ass permaculture design, like neighborhoods of people living, like off-grid, like it just was different, like, you know what I mean? And like I took this class, and that was literally everything else I needed to know about creating a business around mushrooms. So like, my parents sent me out to that, and that same year I started my festival, and I was like out at farmers market every weekend selling my mushrooms. I was like hustling restaurant accounts, like growing as much as I could, foraging. And like, after 2015, like, I mean, I never worked for nobody else again besides like taking contracts to do offer my skills for somebody else. But like, I really did that shit. Like, I was like, I told them I was gonna do that shit, and I did that shit. And like for my dad, like, coming from a military background, like, second generation military, like taking care of your kids and like, and then like standing on your word, like, that's like everything to my dad. So like, I told him I was gonna do that shit, I did that shit, and like, a relationship's been good ever since. And like, now my dad's like even like composting and has chickens and like has a garden and shit. Like, for my dad, dude, like, he used to be like special forces. Like, that was like not the vibes, bro. Like,
do you remember having a conversation with him where you felt like your relationship changed? Or is anything that he said to you where you recognized that relationship shift, as you said?
I mean, it was crazy. There was years where we didn't talk when I was younger because of how crazy everything got. And like, I think it was like, I think it's honestly been more recently, because like, still like, we didn't, I mean, like, still like, we don't necessarily believe in the same political beliefs and all this kind of stuff, but like, we're starting to see the world in a similar fashion. I don't know, just recently he's just been like super proud of what I've created and everything like that, and like, he like knows that I'm good. Like, for so long he will always be like telling me like advice and stuff. Every time I talk, he'd be like, yo, save your money, or like, don't spend, like, da da da, like I'm gonna like fuck it up or something. And like, now he's just like, yo, like, I see you, like, we're good, like, let's do this shit together. Like, really, like, it's not like single moments of like one conversation. It's more of like actions over a period of time as like we start to change our behavioral patterns. It's like my family recognizing that we're all in this shit together. Like, that's where it's at right now. Like my dad, like, recognizing, like, all right, you took care of your family, and like, now we can take care of each other. Like, it's not just like a nuclear world. Like, that's what it was about. Like, you take care of your kids, I'll take care of my kids. Like, because my dad left his family at 17 and was like, I'm gonna take care of myself. And like, that shit was like a big deal. But like, now we're like getting into this phase where we're like, yo, we're gonna take care of each other into the future. Like, that's that shit right there. So like, that's why I'm on with my dad now. And I can't really say it was like a particular moment, but like, after I like started doing my business, like, there was a lot of ups and downs. You know, probably around like, yeah, past couple years. Yeah. Cause it got like really crazy in like the middle there for like just personal shit. Like, but, yeah, it's been really good these past couple years.
What do you, had a storied life, what do you see as your greatest accomplishment?
Like, getting back my family. Like me and my girl, like, split up for a little bit when I was 23. Like, I was still, like, you know, influenced by the world and, like, you know, coming from so many different places. Like, my girl grew up in, like, central Pennsylvania her whole life, and, like, I grew up traveling around the world. So, like meeting in the middle wasn't always easy. And, like, especially as, like, a young man, like, and, like, having such responsibilities and stuff like that. And like especially with like the world at my fingertips and shit my whole life, like, as like after I started doing mushrooms and stuff, like, it wasn't no time before that shit started popping off. Like, around like the time I was 23, like, people started hiring me around the world, or like around the country, to go talk and stuff like that. So I was like able to be around doing whatever I want, have money in my pocket type shit. And like, I let the fucking world get in my head type stuff. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and it can happen to any of us. Like, and I'm not saying like everybody's story is the right way, or like you should have these relationships like a certain way or anything.
What do you mean
like
you let the world get in your head?
Like, I just went out into the world and like I broke up with my girl and like just went out into the world doing whatever I was doing. You know what I mean? Like, just like traveling around, meeting different people, and like I'm not saying it was bad or anything like that, but like it definitely helped with business. Like, I was able to go network and go places I wasn't able to go before, but like there was like months where I wasn't like with my family and shit. Like it was like emotional. There was a lot of like trust issues and stuff like that, and we're trying to like raise a kid like while I'm like traveling around the country, and like she's staying in Pennsylvania, and like I wasn't like making a lot of money or anything like that, so it was like wasn't the easiest. That's what I'm saying. Like, I went through a bunch of crazy shit. I got fucking arrested and stuff like that in the fucking South. Like, traveling around as a young man that's black in this country, you gotta know your shit, especially laws, different states and stuff like that. Like, I got fucked in Georgia. Like, that was wild. Like, it is not legal to be a free, happy black person. Like, unless you're in Atlanta or some shit. Like, you're in northern Georgia, you better, if you have a smile on your face looking like me, you better get the fuck out the way. They still got sundown towns over there. Like, when the sun goes down, they literally are like, yo, no black people are allowed outside. Straight up. That still exists in our country. Like, wild. And I didn't know that kind of stuff, like, traveling around as a young man. You know what I mean? So I'm like, end up in northern Georgia, like, three fucking cops on my ass in the middle of the night. Like, crazy shit. So, like, all sorts of crazy shit happen, and, like, I'm just, like, super detached and, like, trying to, like, raise my family, trying to raise my kid. Like my kids are, like, everything. Like, there's no purpose in life if I'm not, like, making sure that their life is good. You know what I mean? So, like, after all that crazy shit of, like, literally just being a young person in the world and, like, trying to figure out and trying to define your values and all that kind of stuff, like, I made it back to my family, and like now we have another kid, and like we're building trust, and like we're building a relationship that's like the most valuable thing that I have. You know what I mean? Like people value all sorts of money and like instant gratification and this kind of stuff, but like I can trust my girl. Like, that's like a big deal. Like, I can trust her with my life. I can trust her with my kids. I can trust that, like, we'll care about each other and stuff like that. It's really important to me. Yeah.
Man. Dude, I'm so stoked that you are working with Mudwater. And I just really, really see you, man. Yeah, really see what you're doing in this world. And I appreciate that you exist.
Appreciate you. I appreciate the team. I appreciate Mudwater. I mean, like, y'all really have, like, helped out the family. Just like I said, we're still in rural Pennsylvania. And, like, we travel around a lot and do a lot of things, so like a lot of people get this like perspective that like I'm larger than life or something like that, but like we still live in the same house in the same neighborhood and like still trying to figure it out, and like this time around we got a whole team, so it's like a different vibe. But like for me, the community building and stuff like that is like where it's at for like all of this, because now that I've built this like relationship, like I said, with my girl, like it's all about expanding outward. For like all of it, as far as like the permaculture design goes. So now we have a team of people like that depend on our business, and that are acting on a day-to-day basis in the greater good of our family. And I set up my business in a way that is like the best ever, because all we do is create ecologically regenerative, sustainable micro industries. So anybody that's working for Mycosymbiotics, 40 hours a week, you spent 40 hours a week making the earth a better place. Like, straight up, I can say that shit. Like, we're going for B Corp, so like officially we can say that shit, but like we're out here teaching people how to go in the forest, we're out here putting urban gardens in, we're putting compost in, we're like, all the things that we're doing with our 40 hours a week is like good stuff. And so like I just want to create more space for that, and then just keep propelling into future upward spirals. You know what I mean?
William Padilla Brown,
hey.
Anything we can do to support you, man, we're here for it, and really excited for the event tomorrow night.
I'm stoked.
Thank you so much.
Let's grow.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.